Good evening. James McKenna here with my Science Hour. It is December 12th, 2013. Wow, has this last week been an interesting week at, oh man, just the things that have happened. I will touch on some of them this week. I announced on my webpage I would be discussing some, all you can say are a bunch of con men running around building up international award agencies, giving themselves awards, and but what we found is the links with these organizations run much deeper, and so it's these people just but when they're exposed, you'll start to begin to see the web of just all you can call it is cons that are in progress regarding the topic of basically my work. They're trying to replace my work with a bunch of con men. But I'll be talking about that tonight. I'll be talking about giving a Comet ISON update. That's very interesting. There's differing opinions on if Comet ISON is even there anymore. So that's an interesting topic. I'll be talking about the gamma ray burst activity around Earth. It turns out that when they sent up the satellite to measure gamma rays, they were expecting to see them coming from the farthest corner, the most energetic objects in the universe. And it turns out our little old Earth here is the brightest gamma ray object around. And of course, the Sun has gamma ray bursts. But it's very interesting to note that we are seeing gamma ray bursts. Gamma rays, if you look through the electromagnetic spectrum, we start with the microwave, then the infrared, then red, then we go through the colors red, yellow, orange, green, blue, violet, purple, violet, up into the ultraviolet, then to X-rays, then to gamma rays. And so that's in terms of energy of the light photon. So the gamma rays are the really, really energetic ones. X-rays can give you cancer. Gamma rays can give you, they can rip your molecules apart. But at any rate, it turns out that the upper atmosphere of Earth is the brightest gamma ray source going in the near, in the around. So they attribute this in standard fairy tale science to cosmic rays. Now, cosmic rays are high energy protons. These are relativistic protons that come from all sources, including far away distant energetic sources. But the problem is, by the time the proton burst gets to Earth, even if it comes from the Sun, they are very dispersed. It's a very broad wave of them, so to speak. So it's not like they concentrate on one little point. And a single cosmic ray will produce some gamma rays, but not a gamma ray burst, not this big blast of gamma rays from a particular area. So once again, the refereed papers, the papers that try and explain these phenomena, well, there's nobody refereeing. These are just rubber stamped into the so-called respectable peer-reviewed journals and without any real analysis of what they're saying. If they can come close, if they can get 1% correct, then they rely on the fact that interdisciplinary activity in the sciences is absolutely non-existent. So nobody from another discipline will come in, and nobody, absolutely nobody, will rock the boat. Because they all, if they rock the boat, then somebody could rock their boat, and they're sitting on probably a softer set of eggshells than the next guy, as far as their fairy tale science is concerned. So the end result is whatever gets published remains published uncontested. So regarding gamma ray bursts, now imagine the Earth with its atmosphere around it. And at every point in the atmosphere, you have readings from, regarding the activity of gamma rays. So the entire atmosphere of Earth, 360 degrees in all directions, is has all points in Earth's atmosphere, one might say, have been measured with gamma ray bursts. Now, one would expect that there would be an anisotropic measurement. For example, if these cosmic rays were coming from our own galaxy, which would be the primary source for cosmic rays, then you would expect one side of Earth, or the side that happens to be facing the galaxy, because we're way out in the far reaches of our galaxy. We're in the boondocks in the Milky Way galaxy. And so the end result is that the Earth would have an anisotropic concentration of gamma rays that would favor the side towards the galaxy, but that doesn't happen. The gamma ray sources are everywhere in Earth's atmosphere, so there's no anisotropic measurement. So once again, as I say, in the peer-reviewed journals dealing with this topic, they don't nobody gives this a second thought, that the cosmic rays are coming from every place in Earth's atmosphere. So how does that happen, you might be wondering? I mean, we're talking about energies that far exceed anything that comes out of the sun in our little old Earth's atmospheres. Well, here is what is happening. Here's what the real story is. Remember that Earth, like all of the planets, like comets, Earth is discharging the solar capacitor. And what happens is these discharges tend to concentrate into comet-like tails that extend. They're like, imagine a leech on a fish. That's the best way to imagine this. And the leech is kind of attached to the side of the fish, and it strings out behind it as the fish swims along. Well, that's kind of what these are like. These are like electrical connections to Earth's upper atmosphere, and down those electrical channels would be where the electrical currents flow. So when we have storm activity in Earth's atmosphere, all of this is driven from outer space, from these electrical connections. And so when the Sirius currents start to flow, when we have solar storms, or if we have a rapidly changing condition in the solar wind, in the local solar wind, or Earth happens to be aligning with, say, Jupiter or a comet or some other activity that would enhance our electrical discharge as a planet in the solar system, then these currents become much larger. And like I say, the currents tend to concentrate. It's an effect called the pinch effect. It's something I identified in my very earliest work as something that happens in the cosmic electrical circuits. The electrical currents pinch, in other words, the self-induced magnetic field pulls the currents together into a small bundle. And for example, you see this in comet tails. When they first sent a probe, the icy, they called it ISEE3 spacecraft, through the comet tail of Jacobini-Zinner back in the mid-1980s, they encountered rapidly changing positive and negative magnetic fields as they worked their way in through the comet tail. And this is a result of that bundling of current, but of course the scientists swept that data under the rug and never identified it, because they couldn't explain that in terms of a dirty snowball comet. So the end result is that the currents tend to bundle in the electrical discharges of the solar capacitor. So this is what's going on with Earth. Earth is a comet, and there are many sub-comets. In fact, it's safe to say that every low-pressure cell on Earth has an associated upper atmospheric, you might call them leeches, just for a term to explain what they look like, but they're a comet phenomena. Now, I have pictures of these drawn in my weather book there are pictures of these protrusions, electrical protrusions from Earth's atmosphere. And also, this happens to be the source of a lot of water that comes into Earth's atmosphere. We see storm systems that come across land and they develop, and I've shown many examples of this in my radio shows as they've happened, where weather develops over land. In other words, if you look at many broad-scale weather systems, they develop, say, for the United States, they develop over the Pacific Ocean, that brings the moisture in, and then it starts to dump over land, and you can follow that water with the satellite information that we get on a daily basis. You can follow that water in from the Pacific Ocean, and as then it dumps over land in the form of rain or snow and coming down through thunderstorm clouds. And so that rain comes in from a distance. But there are storms in which there is no water that develops off of the oceans. There's no source of water. And, of course, the American Southwest is one of the driest places on the planet. So when you see a storm developing, say, in the Nebraskas or Iowa or the Midwest, and no water has come in from the Pacific Ocean, and all of a sudden you get 11 inches of rain in the middle of the country, where does the water come from? It doesn't just magically appear, and of course standard meteorology does not have an explanation for this. They don't even ask the question, where does the water come from? It just, well, it comes from the clouds. Excuse me for laughing, but I cannot help it at the ridiculous information that's pawned off on you people out there, the general public. But at any rate, that water has to come from somewhere, and it comes from outer space. It comes down those connecting tubes, those flux tubes that connect to the upper atmosphere, and it comes in down through the same path as the electrical currents, down through the storm systems, and ultimately down to the surface of the Earth. But the point, getting back to gamma ray bursts, the electrical currents follow those same paths. And so what happens as a cloud builds, it builds up, and you're all familiar with those beautiful big cumulonimbus clouds that occur when a storm system is forming. That's the finger electrical connection from ground, basically, that connects upwards and draws those electrical currents down. So when it's lightning down on the ground, that electricity is ultimately coming down that flux tube all the way from outer space. These flux tubes twist as a natural process, and that gives the low cell its revolution. It revolves in the northern hemisphere in a counterclockwise direction, and sets in the cusps of the jet stream. As the jet stream winds around that, typically to this to the southern side. Okay, so anyway, back to the gamma ray bursts. Now, the gamma ray bursts are the higher energy sources that sit above the clouds, and that's where the gamma ray bursts are typically observed. Now, with instrumentation, there are phenomenon that are called sprites and elves. These are electrical phenomena that occur above storm clouds. And of course, back in my earliest days when I was identifying electrical conditions on planets, I said that Earth weather, and I identified these phenomena as related to external conditions. When I did my work on Tesla, identifying the electrical conditions in the solar system that Tesla was actually harboring and gaining electrical energy, free electrical energy, free, so to speak, but nothing is literally free. Energy has to come from somewhere. And so what I did is I identified the electrical sources that Tesla was gaining through his Tesla towers. Okay, so at any rate, back to the gamma ray bursts. The gamma ray bursts are in fact, the energy above the storm clouds that are coming from outer space, and the most energetic electrical discharge are above the clouds. So once again, going back to fairy tale standard science, they are trying to tell you that energy is flowing out both sides of the clouds, upwards more energy and downwards to a lesser degree energy, but also in the form of lightning, that somehow this cloud, because it's tumultuous and there's upward currents, etc., they're trying to tell you that electrical energy is flowing out both sides of the clouds, something that isn't even couldn't be true in a third grade science experiment. Okay, so on to the next topic. This is the Christmas season every year. For many years, I gave a series of lectures, sometimes as guest on other radio shows, on the Christmas star. And the Christmas star had to have been a comet, a very unusual comet. And I have given many reasons for this. But oddly enough, when I got done with one of my main interviews regarding the Christmas star, it was highly advertised, pre-advertised. This was with talk show host Brad Walton, now deceased, a good friend of mine. I was on his radio show many, many times. But the Christmas star, I did a special, the Christmas star special, I think it was back in like 2007 or 2008. But the night afterwards, I mean, when we finished and then up until midnight that night, there were 33,000 postings on the internet, on Google, referring to the Christmas star as a planetary alignment. Wow. The response to my giving the Christmas star special showing that the Christmas star had to have been a comet was unbelievable. The amount of misinformation that came out and the number of professional astronomers involved in this, it was staggering. We counted 33,000 references that were posted from the time my show interview ended to around midnight that night. Somebody was very busy. Somebody very much did not want the public to even get a hint of the idea that the Christmas star involved a comet, a very unusual comet. And if you look at the comets that we see in the sky, most of them look pretty much the same. I've given lectures about big comets that have fiery heads and that are shooting out electrical discharges in all directions to smaller objects. But still, that isn't the kind of unusual comet that would warrant thousands of years of expectation. And then finally, for the three wise men from totally different countries to observe this and get on and pack and start leaving on a journey, and I made the point that a planetary alignment only lasts for a couple of hours at best, and then the observation point, the planets move, Earth moves, and so those planetary alignments at best last one night. And these happen all the time. Probably 2-3 times a year we have a visual planetary alignment. And these are strictly visual. They're not really linear alignments in the skies. They just happen to, it's happenstance that the planets in their orbits happen to come up into a line, and they're not even aligned with the sun. So this is not what you'd call a significant alignment in any sense of the imagination. And so planetary alignments could not possibly have been the Christmas star, because these guys had to get on their camels and ride, some of them, for probably over a year as they prepared and prepared all of their equipment and things they had to take with them. They had gifts that they carried from their homeland, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And so this was not just a jump in your BMW and drive across the desert freeway in a couple hours. No. We're talking months and months. And then the Christmas star had some very unusual properties. They saw it in the east originally, but they followed it to the west. Now, this is indicative of a comet, just like, for example, the planet Venus is sometimes the evening star, sometimes it's the morning star. And so a comet many times is the same. We just witnessed that with both Comet Lovejoy and Comet Ison, where it passes the sun, and all of a sudden it changes from an evening object to a morning object. That's very typical of a comet. And so anyway, I went through a long, long laundry list of points that I had to make regarding the Christmas star being a comet. But what was so unusual about the Christmas star? What would warrant thousands of years of waiting? What would be unusual about a comet? Well, it was a comet with companions. And so that would mean that the comet nucleus was significant gravitationally, significant enough to warrant holding a body, a second body around it in a gravitational field. And so this meant that the central body was significant and massive enough to maintain that second body. Because once the cometary activity starts, it would soon lose its ability to hold that second body, and also it would be a planet in development that was historically noted. It was something they knew was coming back. And anyway, this was to significant, the significance, of course, was the Magi, the birth of the Savior of the Israelites, the true Israelites. And so, at any rate, the response, as I said, when I got done doing that Christmas special with Brad Walton, before midnight, there were 33,000 postings all over the internet saying that the Christmas star was a planetary alignment. But at any rate, it's now once again the Christmas season, and I always like to bring that up and make note of that the Christmas star had to have been a planetary, had to be a comet, and certainly in no stretch of the imagination would it ever have been a planetary alignment. Comet Lovejoy continues to be very bright, visible in the sky. It's been one of the longest-lived comets, bright comets, in recent history. And that's what's so very interesting about it, because it was not discovered until it was almost to the sun. It was almost into the field of view of the SOHO cameras, which concentrate just on a very narrow angle around the sun. So this once again proves my point that I've been saying all along, that if there ever were a planetary object that came into our solar system, there's two possibilities. NASA saw this and it didn't tell us about it, or it did not see it with all its sophisticated tracking equipment, etc. And so which one is it? Did they see it and not tell us, or did they not see it and they're incompetent? That the one of the brightest comets in a long time was simply not seen until it was all the way to the sun, far in beyond the orbit of Earth, and of course it was not ever on a critical interaction course with Earth. But the point is that the Comet Lovejoy made it all the way to the sun without any professional observation, and it continues to be a bright object, certainly becoming a permanent member of our solar system. And that's one of the big points too. Somewhere on my webpage, I have a mention of Hale-Bopp, the comet. Welcome Hale-Bopp, newest member of our solar system. And of course, planets develop from comets. Not that Comet Lovejoy will become planet-sized. We don't know the size of its nucleus, but when it came around the sun, it was literally visible before it regained its tail. The nucleus was visible, and it was bigger than the planet Mercury. So that just tells you, and of course, the official story is that it was a couple hundred meters across. Pure fairy tale science. Okay. The NASA SOHO site has been repeatedly down and delivering data late in since the passage of Comet Ison. As I mentioned, the critical time when Aisan was passing the sun, the data was withheld for hours, up to 12 hours we waited before the data was visible. And that was true also of the Tier 2 scientists. So obviously the Tier 1 scientists holding that data, and as I've mentioned on my webpage, the data we see back in the 90s, we had data from SOHO that were, they were gigantic, high-resolution photos of the sun that come from SOHO, and that's the raw data. That is no longer available. Now what they put out for the public to see is just these little, very poor quality photos. So once again, the public is being, information is being withheld from the public. This past week, and now this is bizarre, this is more than bizarre, there has been a rash of articles published in just internet pages by the standard scientists that deal with comets. All of a sudden, they are claiming they have discovered that comets were observed in the Bible. They call them comets of the gods. Now, all of a sudden, after 60 years, more than 60 years of absolute screaming blasphemy, heresy, pseudoscience, and the claims of Velikovsky that comets were observed by the ancients and that should be considered as data, as valid data, all of a sudden, modern science has jumped all over this in 1 week's time. And there are many articles, as I say, they claim to have discovered this. And isn't that an amazing discovery? Now, these people have no conscience at all. Obviously, they are a bunch of Tier 2 quacks, but obviously being pushed in this direction because of the success that I've had in promoting my work to the public, directly to the public. The pressure has become so overwhelming that they've had no other choice than to try and go there themselves. This is what you call in warfare, calling in ground support on your own position. In other words, the fire is so the firefight is so intense that your only chance of survival is calling down the jets to drop bombs on your own position and hope that you live through it and the enemy doesn't. This is what's going on in standard science. This is absolutely incredible. The breakdown, and as I said, it's the only option they have because nobody is listening to NASA anymore. When they post their YouTube videos or science at NASA, people are just laughing at them. Right in public, this NASA, you people are out of date. But they still maintain Dirty Snowball Comet model, and so what they've done is they put a twist to this. Now, all of a sudden, let me just take a side note here. When I produced my 18-hour CD set, MP3 lectures of the physics of Planet X and ancient celestial catastrophes, I identified the Noah's Flood as obviously condition resulting from a comet bypass where we pass through a comet tail for a period of about 40 days. Literally, if you take the Bible literally, it was about 44 days. And that would be about the time it would take to get through a broad comet tail if we were caught in one, and of course the end result would be a tremendous influx of water from the comet tail. So now what does Tier 2 science do? They go, ooh, the Noah's Flood was caused by a comet. But then they say the comet hit the ocean, caused a tsunami, and that was Noah's Flood. Like, wait a minute. Let's get the story straight here, boys and girls. First of all, it was 40 days and 40 nights of torrential rain. It wasn't a tsunami. It wasn't a wave that came across the land. It was rain, torrential rain. It came from above. It lasted for 40 days and 40 nights. It wasn't just a single wave. And also, Noah happened to know about this a long time in advance and happened to build an ark. So it wasn't like he ran out, saw the meteor coming from the sky, and quick built an ark and got all the animals in it. The amount of ridiculousness in these claims that all of a sudden the little tier two science are running up and jumping up and down, discovering that the Bible has something to tell them about comets, is so absurd. It's just beyond any possible recognition of anything sane at all. Then to take it and twist it into the comet hit us on the head and the sky is falling, it's once again absolutely beyond absurd. Okay, now here is a very interesting article. This was sent in by a listener, and I want to dedicate the rest of this show to emails that have come in from listeners. There's some very interesting ones here. This one email says, found an enormous alien planet at the most distant orbit ever seen. Now, this discovery contradicts all of the models that exist in standard science for the formation of planetary objects around a star. And so, first of all, they have a limit as to the size of a planet, how big can they get, and how far away from the sun. And that is because they supposedly form from gravitational collapse of clouds of dust that are surrounding this star. But what's more interesting is the discovery of this planet, which was hundreds and hundreds of times farther than the most distant planet in our solar system, but it is much, much larger than the planet Jupiter, which is interesting. And so, but the thing I found interesting is it was only 13 million years old. They measured its temperature, and it's still very hot. It's still glowing in the infrared, which means that it was a recent a planet that formed recently. Well, now, wait a minute, boys and girls. Didn't the universe form 13 billion years ago, billion with a B as in boy, and then all of the planetary systems formed shortly after, and that's what they rely on when they talk about the equations they've calculated, the Carl Sagan equation for understanding the possibility of life in the universe is based on the age of the universe and the expectation of the age of planets. But if planets are just forming 13 million years ago, that throws that completely out of whack. And but also the model for our own solar system. If planets can form 13 million years ago in other solar systems, why not ours? So why not a planet forming 3,000 years ago in our solar system? Do you see the contradictions here? So just the discovery of this recent discovery of a planet of that size indicates that activity, development, new planetary development is occurring in the universe. So that this idea that everything happened billions of years ago and nothing has happened since is just plain fairy tale science. And whoever came up with these little rules that they follow in standard science, well, that's what they've been following. And, of course, it has no valid validity at all. But at any rate, I want to read the email that came in from this listener because let you hear what people say to me. The subject of the email is Fed Up with Bad Science. Please help me understand. It says, Professor McCanny, I could sit and listen to your lectures and explanations on the physics of space all day and never run out of questions. I believe your theories to be the only accurate models that exist within our world. Thank you for having the personal courage and audacity to carry on despite the ridiculous effort to destroy such magnificent work. Please check out this recent article about the formation of distant stars and planets. I'm interested to hear what you believe to be accurate and what is plain hogwash fairy tale science that has been fabricated without sufficient data to back it up. I am hungry for knowledge. but I only want to retain that which is feasible. Thank you. Here's the link. And so then he presents the link to the title. It was this article actually appeared on NBC News. It says, Enormous Alien Planet Discovered, Most Distant Orbit Ever Seen. That's the title of the article. So that's an email from a listener. Okay, another email from a listener points out recent publications on there's the southern pole of Saturn has a hexagonal wind pattern, and it's always been somewhat of a mystery. It's only visible in it's not visible with visible light, so it was discovered by satellites observing in other wavelengths, away from where our eyes are able to see these patterns. But it's down deep in the atmospheric wind patterns of Saturn, but it makes a hexagonal shape in the polar region around the southern pole of Saturn. But at any rate, a group took a series of vortices and actually did some experiments in the laboratory, and this is one paper that I have to like, because for once someone has provided besides a computer model, someone has provided legitimate laboratory experimentation that shows their concepts. So this is something that I very much liked. They showed that the wind differential in the rotating atmosphere of Saturn, as this played out in the regions near the poles, was due to the interaction of differential in the velocity of the wind speeds that go around the planet Saturn. So I thought that was very interesting. But of course, as with any of these articles, the one thing they don't touch on is what drives the winds. What drives the winds on Saturn? Now understand that if you looked at Saturn, if you were at the planet Saturn and looked back towards the sun would look like a distant, faint flashlight. It would look almost like a star in the sky. It would look like a bigger than average star. Then of course it's going to be not like a dot, but the sun is going to be very small. If you're looking from Saturn, and the amount of energy coming to Saturn from the sun is extremely small. So clearly there's not enough energy there to drive the enormous wind systems that occur on Saturn. So what's driving these wind systems? Well, Saturn is discharging the solar capacitor just like Earth. It's, of course, out there farther. But once these currents begin to concentrate, especially on a big planet like Saturn, then what happens is it starts driving the electric plasmas around the planet, starts supporting the powerful electric field, the powerful magnetic fields. These couple to the external magnetic field of the planet, and remember that Saturn is completely gaseous. So it supports a very powerful magnetic field, and this is purely plasma, electrical current supported magnetic fields. And so the winds are literally coupled. They are just like the Earth's jet streams, as I explain in my weather book. The winds of the planetary winds are coupled magnetic fields. These are electrical currents in the upper atmosphere that are driven and coupled, driven by the electrical system and coupled to the magnetic field of the planet. The positive ions go one way, the electrons go the other way, and that drives the jet streams. On a much simpler basis, Earth has a series of jet streams. A northern jet stream and a southern jet stream are the primary jet streams on Earth, and they move in an easterly direction, and they're very snaky. They go north and south as they move easterly in an easterly direction around the planets. But the equatorial jet stream is negatively charged. It's primarily electrons, and it's very linear. It hardly varies at all from a perfectly straight westerly path around the planet Earth. So at any rate, on Saturn, What you're seeing are the same systems of winds, except there are many, many of them. We're dealing with a very large planet. Just like Jupiter, there's many bands, counter-rotating bands, the positive ions going one direction, the negative ions and electrons going the other direction, and these coupling to the overall magnetic field. Once again, Jupiter, for example, has a very powerful magnetic field, and strictly plasma magnetic field. It is not related. There may be a small magnetic field in the core of Jupiter, and we don't really understand what it is like down there. The best that scientists can figure out is that it is metallic hydrogen, compressed hydrogen, but there's no proof of that either. It could be a very small metallic piece down at the center. But primarily, the magnetic fields of Jupiter are plasma magnetic fields, just like Saturn. So at any rate, the one, and it's not a criticism of the article because that's not their concentration. Their concentration is strictly to look at the hexagonal pattern at the South Pole of Saturn. But the underlying question remains, what drives the wind patterns? And so it's a fundamental question that should be answered before you start to try and determine what causes various patterns, or like in Jupiter, the Great Red Spot, or the Jupiter and Saturn, they have many what they call spots. They're cyclonic storm systems that move with the wind belts. But as I pointed out in my weather book, these are simply cyclonic clouds. They're connected, just like I was talking about earlier in the show, with the electrical connections outside the planet, and they drive these low pressure cells, which basically then spin. The spinning is because the air motion is into the center of the low cell and up the column, and that causes the spinning motion. As the air moves up the column, it's an electrical connection to outside the planet. And so that's what these are. The issue on Earth, we have weather systems just like that on Earth, except what happens is we have land masses on Earth that short these systems out as they hit land. If we did not have land, if we had pure ocean on Earth, we could potentially have hurricanes that would go around and around and around the Earth and keep going forever, for hundreds of years. But they hit land, short out electrically with the land, and stop. They lose their energy, they short out, and the weather system disperses. But on the big planets, there is no land mass for these to short out, so they keep going and going and going. Kind of like the ever-ready rabbit that keeps going and going and going. That's like the cyclonic storms on Saturn and Jupiter. Okay, now the following is very interesting, and this is what I had posted on my webpage. This is, by the way, very important, because this listener, through a very innocent action, has led to us uncovering a very large network of scams that are going on. And this is regarding the takeover of basically my material. And so anyway, I'm going to read this email, and I'm going to just let you know as this unfolded. So here we go. A listener writes in on December 8th. It says, gives a link, and it says, "Worth a look. They are confirming your theory. Have left comments regarding your work, but last time I did, they banned any future comments from me." And so I thought, okay, big deal. And these go through the screeners. And so it's like we receive a lot of these. And over the past few shows, I've made comments that people were being banned from making comments about me or my work on YouTube or any of these other web pages that are posting information about Comet Ison, etc. And if anybody tries to leave a message using my name or information, regarding me or my webpage, etc., they are taken down. And so this, of course, has been going on for a while. Or the trolls, the internet trolls, the other thing that might happen, the internet trolls will come in and immediately slam me in my name, you know, and with all sorts of derogatory remarks. But so we receive these all the time. But over the past week, what I've discovered is many people writing in telling me that when any time the concept or the term electric universe comes up, there seems to be a certain group that's promoting this, but whenever my name becomes associated with it or somebody praises my work or even drops a hint that this is confirming James McCanney's work, it's edited out of there immediately. Okay, so this email did not on the surface seem like anything out of the ordinary. But what happened was very interesting. So I asked for a little more information, and here's what came back. There was a posting of a YouTube video on another web page, and basically they were promoting the concept of Electric Universe. And this is from the Electric Universe clowns that try to copy my work, and the pretend wannabe scientists with no degrees, etc. So at any rate, this listener says, he was clarifying his comments in a follow-up email, and it says, this is the listener writing in, it says, I entered the remarks, it's nice to see Jim McCanney's work starting to get acknowledged. Then he says, on a return visit to the link, I noted my remarks were gone, so I re-entered the same, but was informed by a pop-up that I was banned from making any comments. Slightly annoyed, I logged into YouTube through a different account and placed the same remarks, only to find that they were removed at a later date. When I tried to re-enter again, another pop-up appeared saying that there has been an error with this account. So his second account was blocked for saying the same thing. And then he says, I understand what's going on, James, and of late have been promoting your website at every opportunity. And he says, good luck and thanks for your radio presentations. So here the so-called people who complain about not being allowed a voice complaining about NASA are the biggest censors on the planet. And of course this has been going on for a long time. But what happened, this was not just your average posting, because what happened is this led to a whole series of discoveries. And that's the best thing I can say about this, because what we've discovered is that there have been an entire series of organizations formed mainly in Europe which have been promoting each other. And okay, so here's the scenario. And as of this point, we know about five organizations that have formed. And their point is alternative science, to promote the openness of science and to give a chance for people with alternative science to be viewed and to garner the influence of scientists to promote this concept of openness, and that the standard science is not correct in many of their theoretical viewpoints. So at any rate, this is the alleged point of these so-called organizations. And they have started to give awards from one organization to the other. But what you find is the people on the board awarding the awards are awarding them to themselves. And when we come down to the bottom line here, it's none other than the Electric Universe clowns over there. And so this has unraveled a whole big series of scams of international proportions, where people are creating, and this goes back many years now, and it's just surfacing, that they created many years ago these phony organizations which have started to award awards, international awards, supposedly, and they're called things like the Gold Award of the Telesia Galilei Society of Europe, you know. Okay, so that sounds really impressive. And so they're giving out these awards. But when you look at the people on the board who are selecting the winners, the people on the board are the same people as the winners. And so anyway, I don't want to waste a lot of time on this show doing this, but I want to make it also a comment here. There's supposedly a conference coming up called Electric Universe 2014. And one would think that these people would be announcing and preparing, and it's supposedly just right around the corner, but they won't announce the date of the conference. It's a secret. So wouldn't you expect that an international conference on the electric universe and promoting the concept of openness in science, they would be announcing it because people have to plan ahead. So where do they get the money to put on an international conference at a large-scale hotel facility and to fly in speakers from around the world and pay for all of this? I've been personally to big conferences with 1,500 people in attendance to listen to me talk as one of the list of invited speakers. And it costs a lot of money to rent a hotel, all the facilities, pay for the stay, including food, lodging, transportation of the guest speakers. We're talking serious money here. So wouldn't you want to push the date down when this is supposed to happen? Because, like I say, people have to plan ahead. But they have a little problem, because when they put the date down, that opens it up for the general public. So basically what they're doing is they're having a closed meeting, then having the news media there to post the meeting, but they don't want anybody outside their little circle to be there because of the chance, and now this has happened, where they've been served papers for plagiarism, for misrepresenting professional status, the whole laundry list of issues that could pop up if anybody knew they were there at a certain date. The attorneys would converge on that, both state, possibly federal, and private litigation attorneys would converge on that conference to start handing out citations and litigation to the so-called speakers because of misrepresentation and plagiarism and and a whole laundry list of other items. So isn't it interesting that, these are issues. I don't want to waste more time on my show here. But as I said, this listener email opened up a whole laundry list of, and this was just the beginning, what we have found. In fact, I was going to go through a long dissertation on this on my show today, and I'm not, because what we found is this goes much deeper. What we found is that this laundry list of fake organizations in Europe comes back to the CIA. And many years ago, when the CIA was involved in trying to basically promote people into stealing my work. Now, you got to ask yourself, where do these people get the money to do all of this? There's no visible means of support. So I'm going to stop right there. But this will be a topic that's going to be coming out in the future. And I want to let you know also, I'm very busy with my personal studies. This work is all being done by people, by fans, by listeners, who have been digging into this and coming up with remarkable information. So we'll continue to cover this topic in the future. But I just wanted to give you a heads up on where this is going. And like I say, the listeners out there are bird dogging this, and it's leading into some very interesting deep connections back to, and remember that the CIA is the police force of the international banking cartel. So if that doesn't give you a hint of where this is going, well, as I say, we'll be talking more about this later. Right now, I want to give the quote, what I call the quote of the week. And this comes out of it's a site. I'll give you the URL here. It's called Hubble Site, S-I-T-E. It's hubblesite.org/hubble_discoveries/comet_ison. Okay, I'll do that again quickly. hubblesite.org/hubble_discoveries/comet_ison. Look at the 2:45 timestamp. This is the so-called meeting of the wannabe, the junior achiever, I call them scientists, over at Goddard and Carl Badham's from the Naval Observatory, and we had Hal Weaver there apparently discussing Comet Ison breakup. But look at the 2:45 timestamp. And it says they're talking about the wings. Now, there wasn't just two wings. There were four wings that developed in Comet Ison. And, of course, I gave a lecture last week describing what causes those. But at any rate, the comment of the week is they don't understand what causes the wings. Well, how could you if you think that a comet is a dirty snowball? Why would a dirty snowball sprout four wings perfectly symmetrically, and sustain them? And I love good old Hal Weaver teetering on his stick there. Excuse me, that's a personal comment. I should withdraw that. But he's asking Carl Bathams what that strange narrow spike-like was as the comet Ison approached the sun. Well, of course, it was the sunward spike, and so they concurred that that must have been when comet Ison broke up. So they're misinterpreting a sunward spike of comet Ison as an indication that the comet broke up. And remember, when comet Ison first sprouted wings, they said, oh, the comet's breaking up. And of course, it wasn't. How does a dirty snowball sprout wings? Well, of course, it doesn't. It's just ludicrous. But the comment of the week, they don't understand why a comet should sprout wings. Well, if you want to know, listen to my show last week. I've got about a minute left here. We're heading up to the Christmas time. And by the way, if you order today or tomorrow, we'll still have a chance to get you items by Christmas, depending on where you live, and we'll make every effort to do that. We did have a cutoff date of December 9th just to make sure because of shipping and everything, but be that as it may, just to let you know, if you're new to this show, the purchases go to support this commercial-free show, and so any support is welcome. But if you're poor and don't have any ability to purchase, everything here is free. The web page, the radio shows, and you're going to learn an awful lot. The e-books are very well priced at a very low rate. And by the way, remember that I have the complete libraries there now available, all the books, DVDs, and CDs available in either e-book or in print book format, available at very economical prices. So once again, this is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.